You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 134. Today's episode's about one of New Orleans' most colorful characters of the 20th century, Diamond Jim Moran. On the last show, I was interviewed by James Cullen. I resisted that for many years, but I finally gave in after multiple requests for an episode where I was the guest and not the host. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make the show possible. First up is Patreon. Today's episode is sponsored by our Patreon supporters. Look, if you love the Facebook group, the podcast, and the work I'm doing, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. You can find out more at patreon.com/beyondbourbonst. For the price of a cup of coffee or a beer, you can help me continue to share my lens in New Orleans with you. And if you join at the $10 level or above, we'll mention you on the show. We also have a bunch of partners. These are businesses I support because I believe in what they do and in the people who run these businesses. They include NOLA T-Shirt Club, Bienville Capital, The Occasional Wife, NOLA Boards, Access Strength, Honey Island Kayak Tours, Workplace Solutions. We're going to talk about our friend Paul Mazzacca in a bit. Lizwood Realty, Two Chicks Walking Tours, The Old 77 Hotel and Gulf Coast Mortgage, and Sweet Olive Soapworks. I don't often get to mention all of them, but we had a spot here and I wanted to do that. We'll put links to all of their businesses in the notes for today's show, which will be over at the website, beyondbourbonst.com. Today's topic I want to jump into. Diamond Jim Moran was a local legend in his day. He was a restaurateur and perhaps a raconteur. We'll talk about that. He was definitely larger than life. And to help us learn about Diamond Jim, I am so happy to be joined by his grandson, Bobby Bricotta, who wrote a book about his grandfather entitled Food for Kings. Welcome to the show, Bobby.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited. We had been introduced by our friend Paul Mazzacca virtually, and you were kind enough to send me your book a few months ago, but it's taken a while to get together.
Yes, and I appreciate your patience to get back with me.
Yeah, it's good. I also want to mention, people might hear some background noise, we are recording this at the Bean Gallery, which is on Carrollton Avenue right off of Orleans. So if you take the red streetcar, you can stop by and have a cup of coffee on your way to the city park. We've done a couple episodes about the park, and we appreciate the space here and having a cup of coffee in the afternoon. So first off, let's talk about you. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up here in New Orleans. I grew up on the West Bank in the 60s, early 70s, and then moved to Metairie. And then I've lived all over. And then my father actually bought a house in the French Quarter.
Oh, neat.
And I kind of enjoyed that in my teen years until I left and I went to the Marine Corps in 1979. It's been a while.
How long did you serve?
I served 3 years in the Marine Corps, and then I went to the Army, mm-hmm. and got into aviation there. And then after that, I went into the Air National Guard, and I was in until 2003, until I retired from the reserves. And
oh, wow.
It was in aviation maintenance.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your service. That's awesome.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So how well did you know your grandfather?
Well, I didn't know him at all.
He passed before you were born?
Yes, he died in 58. I was born in 59. So... which made it more difficult for me because I had to learn about somebody that I didn't know, and I knew it. I learned through my father mostly, because my father had a deep infatuation with his father, kind of a love for you know, the love between a son and a father much more than your average.
Yeah,
you know, and my father practiced dentistry for 40 years. And he's deeply always wanted to make a movie about his father, mm-hmm. and he never made it happen, you know. And after he passed, then that's when I got on my project. We can get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, we absolutely will. The book is called Food for Kings, and it's a really interesting, again, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I really love how you have blended sort of the biography not only of your grandfather but of your family along with these great recipes. What inspired you to write the book, to take on the project?
Well, as I said just a while ago, that I wanted to do it for my father. I actually started backwards. I actually, because my dad's passion was to make a movie, I actually hired a screenwriter, and I wrote a screenplay.
Okay.
And I connected with different people in the film industry out in California, and I just got rejected. I mean, the people were excited at first, but once they saw that it was going to be a heavily budgeted movie, because it's so dated, I just got nothing but rejection. So I still have the screenplay. And then I let it go, and then I said, you know what, I can do a book and be in control of that and do it the way I want. And that's that's how I kind of made it happen.
It's funny you say that. I didn't know about the screenplay, but it struck me as I could see this in a local theater production where people locally would really appreciate it and probably have, as we're going to get into, because of your grandfather's so colorful past. There's probably a lot of people in the city that know something about him or know something about one of the businesses, right? And so that's a really different vision than maybe what you had in mind. But I think that would be a really fun way to kind of complement the book, actually.
Yeah. So,
you know, who knows?
Yeah.
So besides the fact that Jim Moran was your grandfather, let's talk about who he was in general in terms of the city and you know, what was his persona? What did he do?
Well, you know, he his parents were from Italy, and his father died of the yellow fever epidemic, kind of a pandemic what we're experiencing now, but on a local level in New Orleans, and it actually killed a lot of people.
Yeah.
So his father died at the age of seven, and he had he had a brother and sister, and he had to go out and hustle in the streets of New Orleans to bring home some money, you know, to help his mother. And he got out there and shined shoes and hustled and did what he needed to do. He grew up there, right there in Royal and Esplanade, and that area was predominantly all Italians.
Yeah.
And so it was a tight niche, you know, community. And most of the people, as it's in my book, he associated with, you know, mostly Italian other kids. And you know, he got hooked up in boxing, and then started refereeing. But he learned to make it happen, you know. Unfortunately, he had to drop out of school after the third grade, so he was a man with no education. So he had the one thing he did learn is people skills, and he was a professional at that.
Sure.
So when he became an adult, that came hand in hand with his restaurant, you know.
Yeah, I was really interested in. You know, so that time when he was growing up as a kid, we actually did an episode about Sicilian Italians in Sicilians in New Orleans, Creole Italians. And you're absolutely right. That corner of the French Quarter was called Little Italy, right? As you go over there near the French Market and really back into that corner towards Rampart and Esplanade, it would have been really common to see Italian families there, largely Sicilian, lots of little shops. You know, today people see Central Grocery. But my understanding is there were tons of the equivalents of Central Grocery. You know, you'd have the people selling dry goods and beans and the people selling cured meats. And, you know, not to mention the fact that right there, it was a bustling market. You know, you had the ships coming in and you had produce coming in. And I also think it's interesting you bring up the Spanish flu. You're right. It had such an impact on New Orleans, very much like what we've experienced today, or worldwide.
Exactly.
You mentioned that he was a referee, and of course, back then, in fact, I think over at the New Orleans Athletic Club, there's either a cast of Jack Johnson or a pair of boxing gloves. There's some tie in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my grandfather and actually all of my family, even up to me, we were all members of the NOAC.
Okay.
I used to box there in my teen years. But, that's where he met a lot of his associates, you know, Huey Long and you know, different people, Frank Costello, you know, I may be jumping around a little bit, but, there was, actually in 1977, my dad got a deposition made, with a masseuse, that used to give massages to, Frank Costello and Huey Long. You know, and they would both be laying side by side with each other, having a conversation as he would massage one or the other. So the guy was privy to a lot of information about stuff that happened. And I actually have that on recording, a deposition that actually helped me put the book together, actually.
Is that right?
Yes, because it was validated with an attorney and everything, you know. Mm. So a lot of those things like that, because as I said before, I didn't know my grandfather, so I had to do research, and a lot of my research that I had that I gotten was through the New Orleans Library. Actually, I spent hours and hours, many Saturdays for a couple years, just digging and prying. And because my grandfather was publicized a lot, he was in the Times Picayune, even all the way back to the teens. I found early 1900s. And so it was easy for me to kind of track his life and fill in the gaps of all the voids that I didn't know about, because I had all these questions in my head. And so I would go to the library going, okay, what exactly happened? And I would dig and dig until I finally found it was like kind of solving a mystery, you know?
Yeah.
It was quite rewarding.
Well, you mentioned a library. The third floor of the main library downtown has just this great archive about New Orleans.
Yes. And that's where I went, on Loyola.
Yeah.
And Tulane.
Yeah. And the librarians and the archivists there are great. They
yes,
just
they
seem
are.
To know so much.
It's probably one of the best in the country, because the Times Picayune goes back to the 1800s.
Right.
And it's all on microfiche, and it's well documented, you know?
Yeah, well, and, you know, it comes out in your book where you really start with kind of the family history even before Jim, right? And the story of your great-great-grandparents and coming over, which was a common story, right?
Yes. Yeah, and as you probably know, and most Italians here in New Orleans, most of the Italians here are from Sicily, mm-hmm. you know? And a large majority of them were from a little town called Contessa Antolina, which I've been, and actually I concluded my book by visiting there and tracking my ancestry. And then that's where my grandmother's side was from. And then my grandfather was from Cefalù, which is a coast, coastal. I don't know if you've been to Italy.
No,
or not.
I've been to Italy. I haven't been to Sicily.
Okay, well, you need to go, because it's quite remarkable. Because what's really neat, and I'm kind of getting off the subject, when I went there, and where do you go to find your ancestry? You go to the cemetery, right?
right.
You know, so, you know, I went to the cemetery, find all these familiar names that I'm familiar with here in New Orleans.
Right.
You know, and I was like, wow, I know that name. And it's really neat to kind of see the connection between Sicily and in New Orleans.
Well, and it, you know, again, we're kind of jumping all over the place, but it also comes out in your book, Italian cooking in New Orleans tends to really be Sicilian.
Yes.
Right? And that also blends into Creole food here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to even a neighborhood place,
mm-hmm.
and the restaurant that I grew up in, my parents, the recipes that were Italian all came from my great-grandparents in Palermo.
Right.
You know, and so you see a lot of that here when somebody says Italian on the menu. I think about Venezia's just down the street,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Very much tied to Sicilian, and probably a place where your grandfather would have been, and certainly some of his associates that outlived him spent a lot of time there. I'm thinking about Carlos Marcello, you know, among others. So let's talk about, I want to get back to the people he knew, but first I want to ask you about his nickname. So how did he get to be Diamond Jim Moran?
Okay, well, so I don't know exactly, like, where it got coined, you know, where exactly, but I did find one article where because he got interviewed by different reporters all the time. They asked him, you know, why did you change his name? Why did you change your name? Well, he did it for two reasons. One reason was because back then, an Irish fighter would draw a bigger crowd, you know, than Italians. And then he also didn't want his mother to know that he was boxing. So he had a good friend by the name of Pal Moran, who was also a boxer. His real name was Paul Mariana, I believe it is. And he had changed his name too, you know. And kind of jump around here, but Pal Moran was actually fighting one time. And at that time, my grandfather had really given up on boxing, and he started refereeing. And I got the article in the book where I had found, he said, a reporter, someone came up to him and says, hey, what are you doing refereeing this fight? Isn't that your brother fighting, you know, Pal Moran? He goes, no, you don't understand. He goes, we're both Italians. We just have this Irish name that we use, and he's not my brother at all, you know, so the fight's not rigged, okay? You know, so anyway, so He had changed his name, and then he also has said he had changed it for business reasons. So when he had four sons, my father and the oldest brother, Nitzi, they kept their name Brocato, and we can kind of get into it on the end, but I had two uncles that kept the name Moran, who carried on the restaurant business after my grandfather died, and they had La Louisiane, and then Moran's Riverside, which was over there where Bella Luna is, where maybe a lot of people today kind of remember where it was, right there on the French Market. My uncle was the first tenant in that particular building, right there on the river in the French Market.
Yeah, it's great views of the river from up there.
You can see the whole bend of the river right there at Algiers Point. So he took it over there, and then my uncle had Tony Moran's on Bienville and Bourbon Street.
Yeah, really famous place. Mm-hmm. You told a great story. I don't remember reading in the book, but I saw it in an article, I think, in the Times-Picayune, about how, besides changing his name, the moniker of Diamond, he really, really, really loved diamonds.
Yeah, well, that infatuation started at the age of 8, believe it or not. And I got the article where a reporter was interviewing him back then. He was shining shoes, and then he was looking in the window of a jewelry store, and he said, "You know, I'm going to buy my first." And he bought his first diamond for $5, which $5 back then was a lot of money.
Right.
And that I think that little thing of when he was 8 of that diamond kind of motivated him to say, you know, one day I'm going to have all these diamonds. And that's when he eventually, you know, as he became an adult and he got into his restaurant business. Well, long before that, he actually had a speakeasy. He actually had an infatuation with the diamonds, and it just grew and grew and grew over the years.
Well, and as I was reading it, and you have a couple great pictures in the book, you know, sometimes today you see, like, professional athletes, right, with lots of diamonds. But I think if your grandfather was alive today, he would outdo all of them, right? He had diamonds on his teeth. He had diamonds on his hands. He had diamonds, like, on his clothing. It just seems like this so much larger-than-life character.
Yeah, well, he was the type of person that nobody was going to outdo him, you know? And I'll tell the one story of how he came about of how he got the diamonds in his teeth. There was a particular guy that was in the restaurant business that knew of my grandfather. He was in Houston, he knew my grandfather had an infatuation with diamonds, and so did he. He sent a message to my grandfather, said, "Hey, so-called Diamond Jim, says, I just got a diamond toothpick. Says, what do you think about that, you know?" And then when my grandfather went out and he got a retainer with it was snapping your palate.
Yeah.
And he got a picture taken, and he sent it back to the guy. He goes, "Look, I don't know what you're doing, if you're selling hot dogs over there, what, but, you know, whatever. But next time you want to fool with a champ, you better come with more than a toothpick, you know?" and so that was just the kind of personality he was. No matter what he did, you know, whether he was putting diamonds inside the meatballs, where nobody was doing that. And so he always had to be one up on everybody, you know? Yeah. So he continued that all the way to his death, you know?
Well, and you brought up the meatballs. I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
So tell the story about that, the meatballs and the diamonds.
So his main thing was meatballs, you know, in his restaurant. So the way the idea came about is my grandmother used to make the meatballs on at her house on Royal and Esplanade where they lived. And then they would send all the meatballs up to the restaurant. Now, his first restaurant was on St. Louis and Bourbon. Hmm. Some people may recall where Al Hertz used to be.
Yeah, his club. Yeah,
yeah, the club. It was right there. And that's where he started in 1947. So all the meatballs would be shipped up there, you know, from the kitchen in the home. But her ring had actually gotten rolled off her finger into the meatballs.
Right.
But she didn't realize until after the meatballs were at the restaurant. Well, she ran up there before, you know, that night before they were serving the people. And she says, "We need to go through these, you know, 50 meatballs and find my ring." And he's like, no. He goes, what a great idea, you know. "No, I'll buy you a bigger and better ring, I promise you, you know." And then that particular night, you know, someone had found the first winner of the ring I found is in my book as well.
Right.
And that was one thing, before I had finished the book, I was like, I want to know when he started putting the diamonds in the meatballs and who was the first winner. So he would always advertise, you know, this Wednesday, you know, there's going to be a winner. There's going to be a diamond that's going to be inside of a meatball. And then after the winner, then the next day in the paper, he would show the winner.
Yeah.
You know, so for
great
advertisement.
Promotion, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was an artist for promoting his business, you know. So anyway, that's how it happened.
I love that story. And could you imagine today, you know, we're so politically correct, we can't even put the babies in the king cake. Can you imagine a diamond ring?
Yeah, exactly. Because I have a couple articles where people actually bit into it.
Yeah,
you
sure.
Know? And
I'm
then,
sure.
yeah. But
it's a great
anyway.
Story. I also personally liked it because longtime listeners of the show know that in my family's restaurant, one of my early jobs was to go make the meatballs. So we were closed on Sunday, and I would go and roll,
there you go.
You know, whatever it is, 144 meatballs.
There you go.
That was my, I was real smooth, so I would bring dates there, and they could hang out and talk with me while I rolled meatballs.
So, but let me mention one other thing, is that that's how my mother and my father got engaged.
Is that right?
So my mother's from Texas, and my grandparents on her side actually used to come to New Orleans, you know, back in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So one particular time, they brought my mom here, and that's when my grandfather had set up an engagement ring to date his son.
And I think you have a picture.
Yeah,
of that,
I have a picture in her. That's one of the. I have her picture in there with the diamond studded meatball recipe.
Right. Yeah. That's incredible. That's great. So, I want to talk about the people that he knew. But since you mentioned it, let's talk a little bit about, in terms of the book. So it's a really interesting concept that you have this family history. Obviously, you have this history about your grandfather, but you really tell the story about the whole family, both in pictures and words. And then in the back half or so, maybe third, you have all these great recipes. So how did you come up with this idea to blend both, to blend the recipes and the family story?
Well, that's a good question, because when I started out, I didn't know exactly how to lay it out, you know. I had gotten with my brother and my sister, who kind of helped me with the book as well, Mary Kay and Joey, I mentioned them. We got together, and I was like, you know, we have recipes, we have a lot of photos, and we have a lot of stories. Why not incorporate all that together and then chronologically start his life from his birth to his death? And then we actually continued it on, like I had mentioned, with my uncles taking over the family business after he died in 1958. And then my uncle's carrying it on until you know, late 90s, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's kind of how I came about the idea, you know.
So there's some great recipes in it, and I also like that it's interwoven with the stories, and some of the recipes are named after your family members, right?
Yes.
And that kind of gets back to, you've talked about the restaurant business. You know, La Louisiana was a very popular, well-known place.
Yeah, it was actually well-known before my grandfather.
Really?
There was, I have the whole history in the book, where I started off in the early 1900s, and there was actually a family used to live in that particular building on 725 Arborville Street, and then there was a guy that actually had the restaurant before my grandfather, and I'm not sure exactly what happened, you know, why he got out of the business, but it was a landmark, just like Antoine's or Galatoire's.
Yeah, absolutely.
In New Orleans, to where it was a famous restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people always say, well, why did they go to my uncle's restaurant, my grandfather's restaurant? Well, they went there because he was one of the biggest equivalent to, you know, Galatoire's and Antoine's. People always wanted to go there. I mean, yeah, they may get a diamond ring and stuff like that, you know.
Right.
But they knew the food was good. It was New Orleans. And my grandfather was the kind of guy, unlike today, where you go to a restaurant, the owner's nowhere around. Mm-hmm. You know, he would greet you at the door. He would come and have a drink with you, sit down, maybe have an appetizer or something. And he knew everybody by name. And, you know, there was that personal relationship with all his clients, you know, all
sure.
his customers, you know.
Well, and La Louisiana had a great reputation all the way through.
Yes.
You know, right up to the end. It was really known as a great place.
Yes.
You know, lots of people, both locals and people visiting, you know, both well-known and not.
Yeah. And I'll add, after my grandfather, everything in his on his menu was all red sauces.
Right.
He had no cream sauces. So I kind of talk about it in my book a little bit, where my uncles, when they took it over, they had big shoes to fill.
Right.
And they knew they're going to have to up their game, you know. So what they did, they actually went to Rome, and they actually bought fresh pasta machines. And I actually started working there in 1972 as a teenager, you know, helping, you know, rolling the pasta and, and making the pasta with those machines. And they were, I wouldn't say they were the first, but they were one of the first in New Orleans to actually, you know, have fresh pasta. And so my uncles actually came up with fettuccine. He was one of the first to make fettuccine. And actually, when my uncle died, you know, they said the king of fettuccine, you know, has passed away. And because he was the guy that actually, you know, kind of built that reputation, you know. So they did quite well for themselves, you know, along with keeping the reputation of La Louisiane going.
Well, and the fact that the, you know, the family business lasted for several decades after your grandfather passed.
Right, right.
You know, that says a ton about it. And you're right. I can't imagine anyone could fill his persona. Right.
Yeah, tough shoes to fit. Now, they did stop putting the dimes in the meatball. Right. I don't think that was cost-effective, you know?
Right. Yeah, could you imagine?
Know? Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things, and again, I'll mention it again. The name of the book is Food for Kings. Where can people get the book?
It's on Amazon.
Okay.
I do have it on eBay, or they can contact me. My email is bobby.brocato@gmail.com.
And we'll put that in the show notes,
okay,
too, so people can reference it.
Okay. And you can contact me. I have a lot of people that contact me. One of the greatest rewards I can say with actually publishing the book is people that have gotten in contact with me that either knew my grandfather or knew of them. Mm. And there's one particular girl that just got in touch with me. I'll kind of touch a little bit about it. She Googled my grandfather's name, and then my book had popped up. So she bought one of my books, and she contacted me through Facebook. She said, "Hey, I'd like to talk to you," you know. And she called me up, and we talked. And what happened? Her great aunt was a flight attendant for United.
Okay.
And she met my grandfather on a flight from New York to New Orleans. So during the flight, he said, "The next time you're in New Orleans, you come into New Orleans on your flight, come to a restaurant." Well, she came back a couple weeks later, and he actually put a diamond ring in her meatball. Because when she was looking through my book, she saw the photo of the ring that my mother had gotten. I put it in the book. She says, "Hey, this is the same ring my great aunt had gotten back in the 50s, in 1951. And so I'm getting stories like that of a lot of people that are contacting me, just sharing wonderful stories about how they used to go there and experience and tell me about my grandfather's personality and, you know, what a nice person he was, you know, because he was very benevolent, you know.
Sure. That's got to be really rewarding to get those connections to your past like that.
It is. It's like it makes it all worthwhile for actually publishing the book.
Yeah, because that's not easy. I've been working on my own book, a travel guide, and it's not easy to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things, and I suppose it's because of his boxing career as well as the restaurant, but he knew a lot of people. He knew a lot of famous people, too.
Yeah, he did. That's one thing I was always trying to answer, you know, not that it's necessary or anything, but it's just me, you know, wondering, you know, how did he meet, you know, Joe DiMaggio, and how did he meet this person, Rocky Marciano and Jack Dempsey, and a lot of boxers, you know? I mean, who knows? I can only guess. I know he was very good close with Joe DiMaggio, and I believe the Pelicans back there were like a double-A team to the Yankees.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I kind of get the connection where Joe DiMaggio where they met so well, you know.
Sure. And in that time frame, Heinemann Park, over now in the corner of what is that, Tulane Avenue
and Carrollton Avenue, right? Where the Fountain Blue Hotel is.
Yeah, exactly.
Used to be.
Yeah. Right now it's
I don't know what it is now.
Storage or whatever it is. But right, a lot of famous ball players played there, and I think it was at that park when they were the affiliates with the Yankees. So that makes sense.
Actually, Robert Maestri was actually the owner of the Pelicans, who was the mayor of New Orleans,
right?
Who was also very good friends with my grandfather.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can kind of get into the politics and whatever.
Yeah. Absolutely. So he knew, you know, and the boxing stuff made sense to me. The New Orleans Athletic Club and, right. and Rocky Marciano and yep. Dempsey. And, mm-hmm. you know, there were a lot of fights, not only later, like in my life, the late fights in the Dome, right, with Ali and Spinks and Roberto Duran. But going way back, one of the first, in fact, there's a marker out in Rivertown in Kenner, right? One of the first professional championship fights in the United States was held out there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
There's a statue out there. I'm going to say it's Jack Johnson, but I'm not really? Sure that it is. Yeah.
It was right there on the levee?
Yeah, right there on the levee. Okay. So Rivertown in Kenner, right? If you just go out River Road past River Shack Tavern, gotcha. You keep going. There's a little Battery Park. I think there's a military memorial, but there's a life-size picture or a life-size statue of the two fighting, bare knuckle fight.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
You learn something every day.
There you go. So, but he knew lots of celebrities, right? And yeah. and the restaurant, again, like you said, it was a well-known spot. People came in and, you know, I wonder, you mentioned the speakeasy. I yeah. know.
So he kind of got into the speakeasy before that, during Prohibition.
Right.
And that's kind of, was one of his first businesses that he had gotten into. And he was friends with different politicians and stuff like that. His, I think the connection of how he met Huey Long is through Seymour Weiss, who was the owner of the Roosevelt Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And because his speakeasy, if you're familiar with New Orleans, was on just around a corner. I'm forgetting it right now. Not Barone Street.
Right around the corner from the Roosevelt?
Yeah, right around the corner. So that's, I think that's where they met, you know. And then, so he was good friends with Robert Maestri and Huey Long. And a lot of people confused and thought that he was Huey Long's bodyguard, but he wasn't. He was a very, very close friend,
mm-hmm.
you know. He was actually supposed to be at the Capitol when he got assassinated, but he wasn't there, and he kind of blamed himself because, you know, my grandfather always carried a pistol with him.
Okay.
And maybe he could have done something right. a lot, you know, but who knows, you know.
Well, and listeners might know Huey Long sort of made the Roosevelt Hotel his New Orleans office, right?
Yeah.
And so he was there all the time. In fact, the Ramos Gin Fizz was his favorite drink, and there was, you know, bartender there. So I could certainly see your grandfather there. Your grandfather also, again, in the book, you talk about he knew a lot of people in organized crime, right? You mentioned yes. Frank Costello and Carlos Marcello.
Yeah.
I assume some of that came from the speakeasy and probably just the circles of the boxing, the restaurant, the speakeasy,
well,
all those things.
The way it came about, I'm not sure who he met first. I think he met Huey Long first because I got articles where he met him in the mid-20s. And then he connected with Frank Costello and different people like that. Frank Costello got ran out of New York with the slot machines, LaGuardia, you know, through all the slot machines in the river. And he really wanted to bring him down to New Orleans, you know. And my grandfather goes, you know, I got a pretty good connection. I know the governor, you know. So they actually met down by the mouth of the river at Pasalutra, is where their hunting camp was, very seclusive, you know. And supposedly they all met down there, and they got it together, and they were going to bring so many slot machines from New York down to New Orleans. But what happened in the meantime, as everyone knows, Huey Long got assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
So it was going to be where it was going to be, you know, legal, and then now it's going to, you know,
right.
you got a different governor, you know. So things changed a little bit. The slot machine still came, but it made it a lot more complicated,
right?
You know. But also, just to back up a little bit, when he had a speakeasy, he actually got raided because they were trying to get dirt on Huey Long. They wanted my grandfather to rat, you know, rat him out, you know.
Right.
And of course, he refused to even say Huey Long was ever in a speakeasy, you know, because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but Huey Long was trying to get to the White House,
right, right,
you know, and Roosevelt knew that, you know, mm-hmm. so. My grandfather took the hit, and they sentenced him 1 year in federal penitentiary in Atlanta, and he served 6 months for good behavior.
Right,
and I'm sure Huey had something to do with getting him out early, you know.
Right,
and but he got out 6 months later. So I'll just mention that. You know?
And he also testified before Estes Kefauver,
yeah.
right?
Yes,
and
Kefauver.
Kefauver, thank you.
Kefauver investigation. Yeah.
Yeah. And from what I understand, he wasn't the most willing witness there either.
No, he wasn't. As a matter of fact, during the hearing, he actually invited Kefauver to his restaurant to have some meatballs, and he even said, you know, you might even get a diamond ring in your meatball if you come visit, you know.
And from what I understand, ultimately he did come, and they became somewhat friendly.
They actually became friends. Actually, I have a quote when my grandfather died that Kefauver said some very, very kind words about him.
You know? That's pretty. I think it says a lot about your grandfather's character, right?
Yeah.
And how he was able to really win people over.
Yeah. And that's why people say, well, was your grandfather a mobster or what? Well, you know, I always say he was kind of like the liaison between the politicians and the mob. Mm-hmm. You know, did he associate with the mob? Yeah. You know,
sure.
Did he benefit from it? I'm sure he did, you know. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't like, you know, a lot of the big mobsters and stuff like that. You know, I got a photo in the book where he's with, big mobsters like Al Capone and stuff like that. So yeah, he was rubbing elbows with those guys, but he also knew how to make things happen on the other side, the political side.
Sure. You know? Yeah, and that's one of the things I thought was interesting, particularly that context that you mentioned about Huey Long had aspirations in the White House, and Frank Costello was involved in kind of those circles, right? Some of the other mobsters in New York, and the politics were really strong. And then that tie into Carlos Marcello, he worked with Frank Costello and that whole thing in the mob to sort of try to bring some things to New Orleans. So, you know, that part is sort of sorted. But I guess where I was going with that is, again, you think back to Sicilians coming to New Orleans at the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a lot of blending back and forth between business and politics and then organized crime. And, you know, I think the lines weren't always really clear. And you probably lived in multiple worlds, you know, where you knew these guys. And even if you were on the straight, these guys were in the neighborhood. You know, it would be hard to not be around them.
Right. Well, you know, my grandfather, like I mentioned, he was very good friends with Robert Maestri.
Mm-hmm.
After Robert Maestri got out of office, I think he served two terms, I'm not sure. But Chet Morrison was the one behind him. And I think one of the main reasons why he got elected was because the public in New Orleans really wanted to clean up the slot machines in New Orleans.
Right.
You know? And so when Chet Morrison came in, he actually destroyed a lot of them and cleaned New Orleans Parish up. Now, mm-hmm. Orleans, right?
Right.
So where did they all go? To the West Bank.
Right.
To Jefferson Parish.
Right.
You know, where Marcello was basically...
And then you get Mosca's out there,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So yeah, that's one thing about Louisiana. You may be able to control the parish, but that's about it, because they'll go somewhere else.
Right. So the West Bank and Mosca's well-known place. Still a great place. A place where Carlos Marcello hung out a lot.
Yep.
But also, there's a music hall these days called Southport Music Hall, just across the Orleans Parish border into Jefferson. And when all of that happened that you're talking about, Marcello and others ran a club, basically a speakeasy / casino there, because it was just across the line. It was in Jefferson. It wasn't in Orleans. So you're right. It kind of moves around a little bit. You mentioned it in part, but what things have you learned in doing the book and then people reaching out to you? What's kind of been the legacy for you about having done the book and dug into your family history?
I tell you, my main thing when I was wanting to do the book was for my relatives. You know, I got a lot of relatives, you know, cousins that called me up just telling me how much they appreciate of actually putting everything together in one book that they can pass on to their children. And that was one of the most satisfying things for me, is that my relatives, mm-hmm. not so much that I please the public, because, you know, the book is kind of personal because it talks specifically about my family lineage, and it may bore some other people, but a lot of people were very, you know, a lot of my relatives were actually very appreciative that I actually put everything about our family in one book.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, having grown up, my dad's family immigrated right around the turn of the century from Palermo. And one of the challenges in the family history is, until, gosh, my great-grandmother, people didn't speak English, right? Even
right.
in New Orleans, they spoke Italian. And obviously, right. In the French Quarter, you would have heard Spanish and German and Italian and French. And so some of that language got lost. So I can completely appreciate. And where I would disagree with you, it is a very personal story, but I also think that's what makes it rich. yeah. not only for your family, but for someone to really kind of get a sense of what it was like for all these immigrants that came and what New Orleans was like at that time. You know, again, I think we talked about it. I did a show with Justin Nystrom, mm-hmm. who wrote this book, Creole Italians or Sicilian Italians. But he talked about how at the turn of the century, Italians were not treated well. You know, mm-hmm. they were discriminated against. And yeah, so exactly. that whole corner of the market or corner of the French Quarter, there was a reason for it. They were binding together and there was some safety there. And I haven't done an episode about Hennessy and the murders there and all that. I need to do that. But that was was sort of for protection. All these families came in and they weren't treated well.
Yeah.
You know, they were immigrants and,
right.
and people didn't think highly of them. What else do you think that you would want people to know about your grandfather?
That he was, you know, he was a guy that worked hard to get where he had gotten. You know, something that really came to mind just 2 days ago, I was thinking about it. I'm currently 61 years old, and my grandfather died at 61. Mm-hmm. And he died April 13th, just the other day. So I'm thinking anything, the life I live after this point is actually a gift in what the life that he had lived. But look at the life he lived in 61 years.
Yeah, he did a lot of living.
He probably did four times the average person, you know. I think what I found out about him, he was a very benevolent guy. He was a family man. He raised four sons to be quite successful in the city of New Orleans, and a great reputation for generations to come. You know, I have one letter here. It was actually shared with me by the girl that I had mentioned earlier about her great aunt. Mm-hmm. Where the mayor, Chet Morrison, actually recognized my grandfather as being an ambassador of New Orleans and a goodwill ambassador, you know. He went to the Kentucky Derby every year since 1928 until his death. And I can get a little bit in about, like I said, we can talk for hours because it's a lot of information there about my grandfather.
Quite a spectacle.
Yeah, he went to the Kentucky Derby every year. They even actually, I got some articles where they paid him to show up
really?
Because because people wanted to go and take photos with him, and he actually would sit there and sign autographs. I have an article where the steward of the track actually came up to him and says, "Look, if you're going to have these gatherings, can you have it not right before post time? Because people aren't going to the
to bet.
They're not wagering their bets. You know, I'm losing money here. You know." So let's get along, and you do your thing, and then we'll do ours, you know. So anyway, I'm kind of making light of it. But, you know, he went there every year. And back then, I guess New Orleans kind of looked at him as a good thing for New Orleans, you know.
Well, and we still have one of the oldest racetracks in the country, you know.
Yes.
Just, gosh, maybe not even a mile from where we are.
Yep.
But where we happen to be sitting is right between what would have been two racetracks. You know,
that's right.
Yeah. And then, again, the fairgrounds is still in existence. New Orleans was a big race in town.
Right.
And continues, really. Louisiana, I think about Kent DeSarmo in the 80s and 90s, has a long history of jockeys and horse trainers. So, that you know, that's interesting. It was interesting in the book and, again, in an article I read in preparing to talk to you about his sort of flamboyance and larger-than-life character carried over not only to New Orleans, but you can only imagine, right, at the Kentucky Derby, you think about the women with the big hats, but he showed up in these terrific outfits. And
yeah.
I could also see it from his point of view of being not only an ambassador for New Orleans, but good promotion, right? He was definitely a promoter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, he was known all over the world. I have articles when he died of all the different, you know, people that wrote about him that knew him. Of course, my mom tells me stories when she went to the funeral. It was I forget the funeral home on Canal Street, but they were lined up all the way down the street, you know, because they wanted to, you know, pay their respect to him. Yeah, he was I think he was a positive thing for New Orleans, you know, and did a lot of good. You know?
Well, I think the book, you really do. I mean, it sort of tells obviously about him, but it is sort of this story that I think a lot of people can relate to. You know, he really, they're immigrants. He really comes from not much in terms
right.
of, you know, they didn't have any money.
Right.
And he grows up to really by hustling, like you said, and gets involved in all these different things and has all these stories. But his legacy becomes, not only is he well-known and good for New Orleans, but he creates these restaurants that just go on for decades, right? And are part of the culture of New Orleans. Again, La Louisiana, until it closed, decades after he passed, was still sort of a New Orleans institution.
Yeah.
You know, you think about that and you think about he knew lots of people across lots of businesses and industries. And again, what I love about the book is it really starts, you know, before him, from your family, and kind of works through all the way through his life. And at the same time, it sort of tells the story of one slice of New Orleans. And so I think, right, I understand that, you know, like you said, your family maybe appreciates it, but those kind of stories help us continue to tell the story of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah. I'll tell you, going into it, I knew a little bit about him because I grew up in the restaurant business, uh-huh. and so I knew that. But I had no idea, really, about sort of the backstory. I knew about the diamonds and the meatballs, but I had no idea how that came about. I had no idea that he was involved in boxing or that he had changed his name, or really that his impact. Again, I knew who he was through the lens of New Orleans, but not beyond New Orleans, right? And as you've mentioned, he was involved in kind of a much bigger figure than New Orleans. And so I think that really comes out in the book. Not to mention, we said it in passing, but you have quite a few recipes here that are great recipes, right? Not only a tribute to your family, but people pick up the book and get this great story and also can cook these recipes. And they're pretty approachable, you know? They're not...
Yeah. I get people that actually are buying the book that knew about my grandfather, you know, back in the 50s. And then I get people that are buying the book because they used to go to my uncle's restaurant.
Sure.
And they were good friends with my uncle. And they just totally appreciate the fact that I actually put this together, you know. So, as you mentioned, the recipes are kind of like a bonus, you know.
Right.
It wasn't just me doing it. I got my brother, my sister, my mother that actually helped me put it together. And a couple of my cousins actually helped me, too, as well.
Well, and in that way, it becomes kind of a family legacy, too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If your family's anything like mine, as the older generations pass, if you don't have those recipes, right, and particularly in Sicilian families, right, it's so much. You mentioned the meatball recipe. And in my own restaurant, or my parents' own restaurant, my grandmother, it was her recipe, those meatballs. So very, very similar, right?
Yeah.
And it's important to capture that stuff before it's gone. So you guys have that not only for yourselves, but for anyone to share, you know, mm-hmm. kind of continue that on. I think it's terrific.
Yeah.
I really do.
Thank you. It was a lot of hard work, and I didn't do it alone.
Sure.
If you look in the front of the book, there's a lot of acknowledgments.
Yes.
And I take time to thank the librarian and everybody that helped me.
You got a couple pages of acknowledgments there. Yeah.
I mean, I had gotten with my publisher, and I was like, you know what? I want to make sure. I know this is kind of, you know, normally people don't go on thanking all these people. Well, I'm like, you know, I don't want to leave anybody out, you know?
Right.
I said, because I didn't do it alone, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
And one thing, I don't know if you mentioned in the book, but as you were talking, I was thinking about the Italian-American Cultural Center downtown in the Central Business District.
There's actually a section down there of my grandfather.
Yeah.
Actually, the books, I went down there the other day and got with Ms. Maselli.
Yeah.
And he actually totally appreciated me bringing him a bunch of books, and he's selling them over there in a little bookstore they have there.
That's a great resource. If someone has an Italian or Sicilian background, they have recordings. I know Maselli's done a lot to try to capture.
Have you been there recently and see the remodeling they did?
I haven't been since COVID started, so I don't know if it was done before that. I know they were working on it.
Yeah, well, they finished it, and they remodeled it, and it's really, really done professionally. You know, before it was just kind of stuff just thrown
like
up
a
on
storefront.
A wall.
Yeah.
You know, but he's done it right. He's put a lot of money into it, which is, I mentioned him in my acknowledgments as well, that because he helped me out with a lot of photos and stuff like that. And he's done a great thing to keep the Italian tradition going on in New Orleans.
Well, and they do a lot there. At least before COVID, you could take Italian language lessons there.
Yeah,
they would
exactly.
Hold, you know, so it's an interesting spot to stop in. And you're right there across from the Piazza d'Italia.
There you go.
Right down the street from one of our sponsors, the old 77 Hotel. It's mm-hmm. right there. Yeah, so I did want to mention them because that's a great place. If you read Bobby's book and you're interested, you have Italian family members, spend some time here. That's a great resource. And Maselli himself is just like this encyclopedia of everything New Orleans Italian, right?
Yes. Yes. And then I'll add in the end of the book, before I concluded the book last year, I actually went to Italy. I went to Sicily and went to Contessa Antolina, and I went to the city hall. And I've studied Italian for years, so I know quite a bit of Italian. And I went in there and met a lot of people that worked within City Hall, and they helped me with a lot of my ancestry. And in the book, I actually have some contacts in there.
Yeah,
where you can you can email them, and they might can help you kind of do some research for your own family.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I'll add, if you get the Kindle version, the digital copy, mm-hmm. I have a lot of hyperlinks that are in the back. I don't know if you've seen the digital copy,
yeah.
but I have a lot of hyperlinks, probably at least 20 of them,
yeah.
where you can click on it and it'll bring you to different sources of information.
Yeah, I actually have. So I have the paper book and the Kindle book.
Okay.
So, well, one of the reasons is I'm getting older, and so it's easier to read the bigger print, right?
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I think, I really think the book's great on so many levels. Like you said, there's something there for everyone, whether they want to know the story of your grandfather or a typical story of Italian immigrants. You got the recipes. I did notice the links there.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think there's a lot there. I'm so happy you wrote the book, but I really appreciate you taking the time to share this with us today.
Yeah, I really appreciate the invite. You know, it's every time I talk about it, I get excited all over again. I know when I get to talking, I'll kind of ramble on and jump around and stuff like that, but I have all of this information in my head that that I like to share with people. And I have many stories. I'll share one quick one.
Yeah.
I know you want to conclude.
No. Go ahead.
Well, there was one particular thing on my grandfather's menu. It's your typical ice bucket, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he called it a bucket of beer on the menu. And he sold it in his restaurant for $2, and he would pour a couple bottles of either Dixie beer or your beer of choice, and you would drink out of it. Well, one particular time, Joe DiMaggio came into the restaurant, and Joe really wanted a bucket. So my father got one. My grandfather got one engraved, and I got a photo in the book where he gave it to him as a gift. Flash forward, you know, I think it was 07, my dad called me up and says, "Hey, you want to go to New York?" I was like, "Why?" He goes, "Joe DiMaggio's having his estate auction." He goes, "And that bucket that my daddy, my grandfather, right, gave to Joe is up for auction." And my dad says, "I'm going to buy it. You want to go?" I was like, "Yeah, let's go." So him and I went, and he did win the bid, you know. And it was kind of funny doing the auction. There was someone bidding against him.
Okay.
And my dad's like, "Hey, this is personal. And I'm not going to tell you how much money he came." But he was determined to go home with that bucket. And he won, and he carried that bucket all the way home. Like a baby, you know, and he was, and that kind of goes back where we first started talking about the relationship with my dad and his father, okay? It was different than the average father-son, and it meant that much where he had to go and buy that ice bucket, a possession that his father had given to Joe DiMaggio.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, since you said that, I'll mention the first time I ever heard your grandfather's name, there used to be, so I'm 50 years old.
Okay.
There used to be a bar right by the Boot on Tulane's campus called the Metro.
Yeah, I remember.
And the Metro sold buckets of beer, and that's the way they served them. I was about 16 years old.
Okay.
You could get in there, and it was $5 a bucket, but the same thing. They would fill it up with draft beer.
Wow.
And if you kept the bucket, you could go back, and it was like $3 to fill up the bucket. All right, you're imagining 16 years old, you're getting buckets of beer, right? And I remember I was a regular.
Uh-huh.
Mom and Dad are listening to this, so I'm sorry. But, you know, I think the statute of limitations have expired, Mom.
There you go.
But I asked one time, where'd this idea come from? Because they weren't putting like six beers in the thing, right? Like you get today, like with the bottles. They were pouring the beer in, right? And they told me that it came from Diamond Jim Moran, that sort of ripped off that idea.
Right? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the Metro's gone now. It's something else. But it was there for decades, like in the 80s, 90s.
Uh-huh.
And that was their thing, right? I think it was Wednesday nights, $5 bucket of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, I had the buckets, right? You collect them and then whatever. So it's an interesting time.
So in the book, there's different actresses and famous people. I even have a picture with Liberace and Sammy Marcello, the son of Carlos Marcello. They're at a table, and the bucket of beer is right there. So it became like a staple, you know, with with people posing and taking pictures with. And there's many, many photos in there.
Yeah.
With different famous people.
The photos are great because it really brings the story to life.
Yeah. Let me just add, I know the color book is quite more expensive than the black and white, but because it's so saturated with, you know, images and photos, I hate to even sell the black and white
right.
because it doesn't do the book justice.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you agree or disagree.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the pictures are old, obviously, right? So
yeah.
It's,
yeah.
You know, they're not like taking a digital picture today. So the more that you can get them. Yeah, I think it just brings it to life. Obviously, I can see how excited you are about it. I was excited to do this. I'm sorry it took so long, but I'm glad to have you on. And again, Bobby, just thank you so much for the time.
Okay, appreciate it, Mark. Thank you.
Hey, if you guys enjoy the show, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. And do me a favor, if you enjoy listening, please share it with somebody else that loves New Orleans as much as me and Bobby do. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. And until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.